Welcome to the Jeffers Brief, only on Contra Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Jeffers Brief. I'm John Jeffers, your host, humble and grateful that I is. And I am because you're listening, and I appreciate it. And I need you to listen and rate the shows. Hey, if you're listening on KYAH, 540 AM, Utah's Talk Authority, do me a favor, give them a call, tell them you like it. Send them an email, tell them you like it. I'd appreciate it. If you're listening in on, say, iTunes, Stitcher, Player.fm, iHeartRadio, all that stuff, rate the show. Just take a few extra seconds, rate the show. I appreciate it. It helps out a lot. It really does. And before I forget, I want to thank, who is it? We just had one of our listeners decide that he or she donated to help keep the show going. I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I believe if I'm reading their call sign correctly, it's SAGPAZ. Could be SAGPAZ, I suppose. But thank you. I appreciate it. As do Don and Mark, Glenn and Shelby. All the hosts appreciate it. But if you're going to support us, and I think you should, if you like what you hear, do me a favor. Go to Contra Radio Network.podbean.com. You'll see it pop up there. Push donate. I've been asking for a while now for $2 a month. $2 a month. I mean, come on. That's the price of a coffee. And I'm only asking for a month. Now, many times others give more, and that's much appreciated. But I'm just asking for $2 a month. I mean, come on, really? I'm asking you. $2 a month. I think the show is worth $2 a month. Contra Radio Network has, four or five shows under its umbrella, and I got to tell you, I think it's worth the $2 a month. All right. What else did I want to talk about? We got some other stuff we got to get to. Well, what else did I want to talk about? It'll come to me eventually. I'm sure it will. All right. I just got word from KYAH. Some of you want to know where you can listen to our new show called The Patriot Alliance. Right now, it's only a podcast. We're testing it out. We want to see how we go with it, how it works, if people respond to it or not. And where do I listen to it? Well, I'm going to tell you. Go to podbean.com, punch in Contra Radio Network. The show will pop up. And you will see a list of shows. And part of the shows you will see is the Patriot Alliance. Now, the Patriot Alliance is a roundtable discussion. Anybody can call in on Saturday nights and participate. Anyone can. You don't have to be an expert in any particular subject, but you just want to chat. Think of it this way. Think of it, you're sitting in a bar having a beer with some friends, and you're just chatting. Same concept. We do start off on, I'm going to tell you right now, we start off on one subject and it kind of rolls into, other subjects that we weren't planning on getting into, but we get into it because that's the way the conversation flows and that's what we do. So that's how it works. Good? Yes? And if you want to know the phone number, do me a favor. You can go to Facebook because I put the announcement on there about the time and the phone number, how to get in directly to us. All right? That's how it works. Pretty cool. I think we can all live with that. We're still trying to work out on Skype, make it easier that way. The problem we're having is that when Skype comes on, it has a tendency to really just override the conference call line. So we're still trying to work that out. But that's how you do it. That's what's going on there. All right. Did I cover everything? I think I did. All right. What else is coming? All right. Sundance has reported. And you know what? You're not going to hear this. They're not going to tell you. The mainstream media, those lapdogs of the Democrats, will not tell you this. But I will. I will. And I'm going to. Some of the first things that Sundance has talked about is that Michael Cohen admits to coordinating scripted testimony with Lanny Davis, Adam Schiff, and Elijah Cummings. Those who follow closely will note Speaker Pelosi's plan to weaponize congressional oversight is a carefully orchestrated campaign with three key figures: Adam Schiff, Elijah Cummings, and Jerry Nadler. Representative Jody Heiss questions Michael Cohen about the construct and background of his congressional appearance. Within the answer, Cohen admits his handler, Democrat operative Lanny Davis, coordinated with key congressional leadership to include Oversight Chairman Elijah Cummings and the House Intel Chairman Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff, who, by the way, is the three-eyed raven. He's seen all the evidence. He has evidence. When he's asked us to, bring it out, show it to us. Oh, no, not yet. Can't do it yet. Yeah, he knows he has all this stuff, yet it never appears. He's the three-eyed raven. So the way to defeat the Pelosi-Schumer impeachment scheme is to expose the cornerstone of the political fraud the scheme relies upon. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, every time I say her name, I just want to, throw up in my throat. Has worked closely with House Oversight Chairman Elijah Cummings to use President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, as a cornerstone to a carefully planned Democrat impeachment effort. Please do. Please do it. It will backfire on them so fast their heads will spin. But working collaboratively with current officials inside the U.S. Department of Justice, specifically Robert Mueller and the Southern District of New York, Speaker Pelosi organized a deferment of prison sentence for Mr. Cohen so he could testify to the House committees. Toward that end, and in fulfillment of his agreement to House Democrats via Lanny Davis, we see the Cohen testimony. Depending on how well the media is able to exploit the damaging testimony from Cohen, Special Counsel Mueller will time his investigative report to AG William Barr. The background between Pelosi Schumer's Congress and Attorney General William Barr will be aided by the leverage Pelosi, Schiff, and Cummings, and Nadler are able to generate from Michael Cohen. That's why Cohen's public testimony was never optional. All this carefully designed, none of this is organic. All the participants have networked contacts acting as intermediaries, like Lawfare, to provide arm's-length plausible deniability to the larger political scheme. These plans and schemes are all professional Democrats spend time thinking and talking about. This is what they do. This is all they do. This is their purpose in life. Nothing else matters. Right, DACA recipients? Huh? How many times have you been passed over? Yeah, identity politics works real well until the groups that support you all want something that's 180 degrees opposed for what they want. So therefore, identity politics fails. But that's another story. Now, in the new House rules Pelosi unveiled last December, the House Intel Chairman Adam Schiff has until April 15th to organize his summer hearing schedule for attacks against the White House. Pelosi hasn't tried to hide the plan. Heck, she's published it all for us to see, and she has. I've told you about it right here on this very show. So expose the scheme by outlining the sequence of events prior to their ability to trigger them, and the fraudulent house of sketchy cards collapses. Here, shall we listen? Shall we listen to our boy Jody Heiss grilling Michael Cohen? Here, let's listen to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Meadows, the chairman made me, the ranking member made me aware that I had given a little more time to Ms. Wasserman Schultz. I was going to let you do that anyway. But I just want the committee to know that because there's so many, I'm going to be strict on this 5 minutes, all right? All right, thank you very much. Mr. Ice, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cohen, you claim that you've lied, but you're not a liar. Just to set the record straight, if you lied, you are a liar by definition. You also said a moment ago that the facts are inaccurate. If they are facts, they are accurate, and that would make you inaccurate. But I'd like to take a moment to, I'd like to know who you consulted with to prepare for today's hearing, Lanny Davis, and who else?
I consulted with my counsel, Lanny Davis, as well as Michael Monaco.
All right. Did you or Michael or Lanny Davis or anyone else cooperate with the Democratic majority to prepare for this hearing?
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
Did you or anyone else on your team cooperate with the Democrat Party in preparing for this hearing?
We've spoken to the party.
Okay, did you prepare with Chairman Cummings or anyone on your team?
I'm sorry, what do you mean by prepare?
Prepare for this hearing.
I prepared with my counsel.
Did you prepare with any, the Democrat majority or Chairman Cummings?
We spoke with Chairman Cummings and the party.
With Chairman Schiff?
Spoke with Chairman Schiff and his part and his people as well.
Were there any other individuals acting as a liaise for you with the majority party?
I'm sorry, sir. What are you saying?
Did you have a liaison other than these that you've mentioned who were working with the majority to prepare for this hearing?
We spoke with the various individuals that you just raised, yes.
Tom Steyer, regarding him or any of his representatives, anyone associated with him, is he or any of them paying Lanny Davis? Who is paying Lanny Davis?
At the present moment, no one.
So he's doing all this work for nothing?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I hope so.
I kind of doubt it, but how did Lanny Davis come to represent you? Did he approach you or did you approach him?
I reached out to Lanny Davis at the recommendation of my former counsel over at McDermott, Will, and Emery, who knew Mr. Davis and Mr.
So
Davis.
You reached out to Mr. Davis?
I did, yes, initially.
Okay, so Did you want to testify before Congress, or did he urge you to testify here?
I was asked to come here, and I am here, sir, voluntarily, because it's my
decision.
You were
asked by who? My question, did he ask you to come here?
No, sir.
Okay, because he says that he did ask you to come here and that he convinced you, and also that he did the same with Chairman Cummings as well. So your testimony here is that you approached Lanny Davis to represent you and to come here. He did not persuade you to come here.
He did not persuade me. Actually, Chairman Cummings, which is part of the conversations that we engaged in with his people, as well as Chairman Schiff and others, we spoke in order to ask me to come here voluntarily.
I find the connecting of the dots here with Mr. Davis and you and, frankly, the chairman and perhaps others to be rather stunning that there is an agenda for all this happening here today. And I believe, frankly, that that's to bring the president down, to impugn the president. You made an oath last time you were here, and that oath meant nothing to you then. We had an oath here in this very room about a month ago, and it was, quote, be clear that I will seek the truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God, end quote. That sounds like an oath to me. The chairman made that statement in this very room last month. But here we are today, our first big hearing with, as you and we all know, a convicted liar, lying to Congress, a criminal. And I believe this witness is totally incompatible with the stated goal of having to seek the truth in this hearing. This is the first time in the history of Congress we have someone testifying here who has already been convicted of lying to Congress. So congratulations for being the first in Congress to do that, and Mr. Cummings as well. I can't believe we have brought this committee to its knees in terms of losing its credibility, and it's a shameful mockery of what our purpose is. I yield back.
Gentlemen, Simon.
Well, there you have it. And Cone even had, you know, no sense of shame whatsoever. He says, oh, thank you. You moron. Yeah. Hey, here's something you're not going to hear about. You're going to like this one, I promise you. You're going to like this. This is cool. And I haven't heard it from any of the media yet. So, but you're going to hear it here. And that's the cool thing. Did you know that President Trump has signed a trade deal for $21 billion with the Vietnam aeronautics sector? Did you know that? Of course you didn't. Because you know what? The media's never, ever, 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 ever going to give this president a win on anything. They want to convince you that this guy is a loser in every respect, and he's a... Never mind. You know where I'm going with it. But the facts are not to the media's liking. So on the sideline of President Trump and Chairman Kim's summit in Hanoi, Vietnam, President Trump and Vietnamese President Nguyen Phu Trong participated in a signing ceremony worth a combined $21 billion value in U.S. trade. The contracts were signed by Kevin McAllister, President and Chief Executive Officer of Boeing Commercial Airplanes, and Alan Paxson, Vice President of GE Aviation. On the Vietnamese side, Nguyen Thanh Hung, Vice Chairman of Vietjet Air, and Nguyen Thai Phuong Thao, President and CEO of Vietjet. Details include, but are not limited to, we'll buy 100 Boeing 737 MAX jets and 215 GE CFM joint venture engines. Bamboo Airways will buy 10 Boeing 787-9 jets, and Vietnam Airlines will buy $100 million in services and technology from the Sabre Corporation. These deals will support more than 83,000 American jobs and provide increased safety and reliability for Vietnamese international travelers. Don't believe me? Listen. Don't believe me? Listen to this. You know what? This goes on for 8 minutes, and I don't know when it kicks in, so guess what? I'm not going to waste your time or mine. Trust me, it happened. Okay, what else have we got? This is interesting. And really, this is directed to you farmers out there listening, especially those within earshot of KYAH. To revive rural America, we must fix our broken food system. You're thinking, John, what are you talking about? Well, I'm going to tell you what I'm talking about. You know, America's agriculture system has become extractive, and more of the profits are flowing to a few people. Now, you're saying, well, what's going on here? Well, Austin Friedrich of the American Conservative wrote this, and this is something I think that we need to understand. We all need American farmers, period. You like eating? You better be kissing the farmer's ass. That's the bottom line. Oh, and while you're, and after you're done kissing their backside, you need to start carrying, you know, you start kissing the truck drivers who deliver it. Yeah, that's right. You can start kissing their backside also. A senior official at the Iowa Farm Bureau, the nation's largest agricultural organization, recently told me that the most rural communities will soon disappear. Even though the organization's nominal mission is to help farm families prosper and improve their quality of life, The official seemed accepting of this fate, even a bit happy about it. Either way, he told me that nothing could be done. Either way, sorry, nothing could be done. The thing is, the senior official isn't wrong. The outlook for rural communities is grim. There are fewer jobs than there were a generation ago, and the ones that remain pay lower and lower wages. America's agriculture system is predicated on an extractive model, where more and more of the profits flow to a few. If current trends continue, rural America will soon be owned by a handful of families and corporations who will run their empires remotely with driverless tractors and poorly paid staff. This decline occurred as a result of deliberate policy decisions made by politicians from both parties who favor multinational corporations at the expense of rural communities. But the contrary to what the senior official at the Iowa Farm Bureau said, rural America can be revived. It has a future, but only if we challenge who holds power in the current system and create an agricultural system that rewards meaningful work. Economic power is more concentrated today than at any other point in American history, and nowhere is this power more apparent than in agriculture. The American food supply chain. From the seeds we plant to the peanut butter in our neighborhood grocery stores, it's concentrated in the hands of a few multinational corporations. This concentrated power comes at the expense of farmers and workers. Because the supply, processing, distribution, and retail networks are controlled by only a handful of firms. Farmers face higher costs for their inputs and lower prices for their goods. In the 1980s, 37 cents out of every dollar went back to the farmer. Today, farmers take home less than 15 cents on every dollar. This new economic reality forces farmers to survive on volume, creating a system where only the largest farms can make a living. Yeah, think about that. The nation's meatpacking industry is now more concentrated than when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle more than a century ago. Four companies, two of which are foreign-owned, now slaughter 52% of all meat consumed in the United States, more than twice the market share than the four largest companies held in 2002. As journalist Christopher Leonard documents in The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business, the current system closely resembles sharecropping. Large corporations like Tyson Foods will only slaughter a farmer's chickens if he has an exclusive contract with the company. In many rural communities, a farmer raising animals for slaughter has the quote-unquote, you know, choice of selling to only one slaughterhouse. And because Tyson is often the only buyer in town, it calls the shots, dictating everything from the facilities a farmer builds on her farm to the feed she uses, to the price the farmer receives for full-grown chickens. The farmer has very little power in this transaction, and this asymmetry is a key factor in why 71% of American chicken farmers live below the poverty line. This has to change. For slaughterhouse workers, industry concentration has contributed to wage stagnation over the course of the past few decades. Workers at a Hormel slaughterhouse in Austin, Minnesota, made $10.69 per hour in 1985. That's pretty good money then. Which is equal to $25.04 in 2018 when adjusted for inflation. But 33 years later, the average slaughterhouse worker makes less than $3 more. Meanwhile, Wan Long, the chairman and CEO of WH Group, the holding company of Smithfield Foods, made $291 million in 2017, the equivalent annual wages of 10,457 slaughterhouse workers. Talk about having blood on your hands. Because farmers and other rural workers make less money, they also spend less money within their communities, creating a ripple effect that negatively impacts other local businesses. As a result, rural communities are hollowing out. Young people are leaving in droves, and the folks left behind are struggling to make ends meet. The recovery from the Great Recession was an urban phenomenon. If rural communities had matched urban employment growth trends, they would have added more than 850,000 new jobs. But according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, rural areas still have not even recovered the jobs they lost in the recession, and many never will. A handful of trends reflects this loss of opportunity and the decline in living conditions. Medicaid now pays for more than half of the births in rural hospitals. Suicide rates are higher in rural America than in urban America, and the gap is growing. The overall violent crime rate in Iowa rose by only 3% between 2006 and 2016, but grew by 50% in communities with fewer than 10,000 residents. The opioid epidemic thrives from the desperation created by these economic circumstances. Thus, it is little surprise that rural communities simmer with a resentment that contributed to the election of Donald Trump. Growing up, I worked at my mom's bakery in Iowa and was paid in cookie dough. I operated the register, cleaned the store on Sundays after church. Many of my mom's customers knew how I was doing in school, and I learned about the happenings in their lives. In a sense, they became a part of our extended family. Our family bakery closed a decade ago, but my mom remains close to many of her customers. These folks could have bought coffee anywhere, but they chose my mom's bakery because of the care and pride she took in serving them. My dad worked as a beer salesman, supplied most of the gas stations in our town. The job involved tailoring the promotional displays at stores according to demographics and local events in an effort to generate a surge in demand. For me, this meant I grew up with a lot of leftover beer display items to play with, from blow-up beer chairs to Red Dog stuffed animals. To this day, I still notice well-crafted merchandising because I know the time and skill that goes into it. Now, I mention these experiences because they shape how I view the role of power between food industry workers and business. In both of these professions, my parents had freedom and autonomy. Most workers today, however, do not enjoy the same freedom. Decisions are made by 20-something consultants in distant cities who have never worked the front lines and cannot possibly understand the day-to-day realities of their businesses. Starbucks, for example, dictates exactly where each branch manager must place each item on their shelves. Chain gas stations and big box stores do the exact same thing with beer. Now, these faceless multinational corporations strip workers of their dignity and respect, a fact that is often lost in the recent discussions about economic consolidation. This dynamic is not easily quantifiable, but it's easy to recognize when you ask workers what they think of their employers. Look no further than a candy company in Creston, Iowa, that fired more than 250 workers days before Christmas last year after being bought out. To the company, these workers are merely seen as a number on some faraway Excel spreadsheet, not as parents who had to go home on Christmas without jobs. Every year brings a new best-selling book that documents how broken the American food system is. The current Democratic Party platform mentions agriculture and food 6 times each. The Republican Party mentions them only a few times more. But neither party recommends substantive changes to the current system. The recently passed Farm Bill, which received significant support from both parties in December, largely maintains the status quo. The crop subsidy program, for example, will continue to give 80% of all farm subsidies to the top 20% of American farmers. It is little wonder that monopolies and corporate farms have grown more powerful at the expense of workers and family farmers. Beyond the Farm Bill, the inability of either party to change concentrated power in the American food system is best illustrated with the meat monopolies. Now, the Obama administration tried to stand up to chicken monopolies by proposing new regulations to prevent abusive behavior, but cowered when the industry pushed back. If the Democratic Party ignored the concentrations of power of the meat monopolies, the Republican Party, particularly under Trump, has exploited and entrenched it. The Trump administration recently increased the speed caps for killing lions in slaughterhouses and is considering removing them for hogs, making dangerous work even more dangerous. Can it be? Is it? In November, the administration eliminated the Grain Inspection, Packers and Stockyards Administration, an agency under the United States Department of Agriculture that oversaw enforcement of antitrust law in the meatpacking business. In doing so, it removed one of the few safeguards for workers and small businesses in an already unbalanced marketplace. America's agricultural system should allow regular folks to make a decent living producing food. Deliberate policy decisions caused the decline in farmers' share of the food dollar, and many of the same policy decisions explains why wages for slaughterhouse workers have stagnated during the past three decades. Reversing these decisions can help farmers, slaughterhouse workers, and families within the food industry, and would help revive rural communities. There's a number of simple actions that can help reverse the downward trajectory. For example, a ban on contract farming and tournament-style pricing would help realign the power dynamics between chicken farmers and the large corporations that exploit them. For workers, capping the killing line speeds at slaughterhouses and requiring meat inspectors to be public employees would similarly realign these dynamics. These actions would level the playing field for farmers, workers, and small businesses, and restore dignity and respect to workers at all levels of the American food system. You know, hold on here. I want to take a second here. And that is this. Many people, especially in the urban centers of America, look down upon the farmer. They look down upon the people, the very people that feed them. They think they're so superior to those people. Well, I got a college degree. I'm living in the city. I'm smarter. I make more money. Really now. What are you going to eat when the farmers are done? Who's going to watch the corporations? Everything has to be in balance, people. It must be in balance, and it's not. You know, some years ago, one of my partners, we were talking, and he said practically the same thing I'm telling you now, and that is this. People who work in the service industry, for example, whether you're working as a cook, you are working as a maid at a hotel, or a janitor, or whatever. Those people in the service industries are looked down upon. And you know it's true. You know I'm telling you the truth. You know I am. Let's get back to it. But the best way to reshape America's food system to benefit rural communities is to restore competition by replacing the current pro-monopoly antitrust regime. In The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age, Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu records the enforcement history of anti-monopoly laws in the United States. For much of the 20th century, the federal government administered an antitrust framework that sought to avoid concentrated economic power. This framework helped ensure competitive balance and sparked broad economic growth that benefited workers across the economic spectrum. But in the early 1980s, the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice, influenced by the work of Robert Bork, pared back antitrust enforcement. Bork argued that the government must only focus on the impact of consumer prices when assessing anti-competitive harm. This approach, known as the consumer welfare standard, has resulted in less antitrust enforcement, and with the assumption that larger firms can create efficiencies that lead to lower prices for consumers, firms have gotten bigger and industries have become more consolidated. The problem with the consumer welfare standard is that its basic premise has been disproven. In Merger Control and Remedies, a retrospective analysis of U.S. policy, economist John Kwaka analyzed the effects to prices after mergers. After reviewing almost 200 recent mergers, he found that post-merger prices increased by an average of 4.3%. Thus, the consumer welfare standard fails. It fails to meet its own modest goal of reducing consumer prices. Yet despite this evidence, This broken enforcement strategy continues to be supported by both major political parties. Perhaps most importantly, the consumer welfare standard is a misguided enforcement strategy because it does not account for the chicken farmers who are squeezed by Tyson, or the slaughterhouse workers whose wages have stagnated even as profits within their industry have soared. It does not account for the ripple effects that harm small business or the communities that have been hollowed out, as the industries that support them wither away. And it doesn't offer relief to people like my parents, who took pride in their work and were trusted by the communities that they served. It's time to turn the page on this failed theory and put the anti back into antitrust. The decline of rural communities and the consolidation of the American food system was the result of deliberate policy choices. If we acknowledge the consequences of choices, then we can understand why the grim future projected by the official at the Iowa Farm Bureau is possible. But that our fate is not yet sealed. Rural America can thrive once again, but only if we're willing to challenge who holds power in the current system. I think it's important. That's why I'm telling you about it. All right. How much time have I got? Let me see. Oh, plenty of time. Plenty. All right. What else we got here? All right. Okay. You ready for some more? Now, look, I'm going to tell you about this. I don't want you guys getting crazy and deciding that, don't put your car in the ditch when you're listening to this, all right? Sundance has reported that Jim Jordan has outlined political scheme of House Oversight Committee, and Chairman Cummings is issuing nonsense subpoenas. So earlier today, ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, Jim Jordan, delivered remarks outlining the political schemes of the committee led by Chairman Elijah Cummings. Yes. In a brief 5-minute outline, the Representative Jordan explains the motives, purposes, and narrative intents of the Pelosi plan to build a false impeachment premise, i.e., we're building the Trojan horse. It's true. Jordan's approach is spot on. The baseline to deconstruct the insufferable plans of Pelosi's three-headed Cerebus, which is Schiff, Nadler, and Cummings, is to expose the plan prior to rollout. Once the electorate become aware of the Pelosi scheme, they can see through the insufferable narrative engineering. It's all a con, and all designed for maximum political value. There is a unified plan amid the resistance movement to use the impeachment process for political gain. Part of that plan includes the exploitation of testimony from who? Michael Cohen, to facilitate their designed sequencing of events. Following Cohen's testimony, Mueller will deliver his final report on the Trump-Russia probe. Again, there is very little doubt the approach has already been mapped out in post-election meetings between Pelosi, Schumer, the Democratic committee heads, allies in the lawfare community, political allies inside the executive branch, along with feedback from political networks, DNC Perez, and major resistance donors. All right. The baseline here is that everything the institutional left does is sequential and planned. That is what they do. This is all they do. None of the characters within the institutions of professional leftism create anything, build anything, have a life purpose for anything other than organizing their efforts to exploit control of others via politics. This is all they know how to do. When you develop your skills to see their patterns, you can see the predictability behind it. When we approach the term impeachment, we are not discussing as a technical legal approach for removal of the president, but rather the political use of the process to damage President Trump. The House Democrats and their allies write large will use this process and to try and stop President Trump's re-election. Professional political Democrats would not be using impeachment in the constitutional sense of the process, but rather weaponizing the process as a tool itself to target the executive office, diminish the presidency, isolate, marginalize the Alinsky rules, and position themselves for 2020. Optics and innuendo are key elements, tools per se, in the Alinsky narrative engineering process. That's why Pelosi, Schumer, and the Democratic machine are going bananas about getting a raw Mueller deal and not a version from AG Barr. Got it? The Mueller report, written in full alignment with the resistance movement, will be structured to be damaging to the president as possible. There's no actual Trump-Russia collusion, but the report will indicate a willingness of the targets to participate in a collusion-esque process. Don't discount Mueller's ability to fabricate appearances and have half the country believe it. Speaker Pelosi and Adam Schiff, Elijah Cummings, House Oversight, and Jerry Nadler, House Judiciary, are working with Robert Mueller and current DOJ officials on a very carefully constructed plan toward the goal of an impeachment vote against the sitting president. The first phase events include testimony by Michael Cohen and the public release of the Mueller report. There will be a press spectacle designed for maximum exposure. The tail end of that phase will lead to more hearings throughout March, perhaps into early April, with subpoenas based on the framework of that report. You know, as Mike Tyson used to say, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. Well, that's true. And what do we got here? Let's listen to Representative Jordan here.
Appreciate you convening this business meeting so that all members of the committee may have the opportunity to engage in a dialogue about the necessity of issuing three subpoenas, the first subpoenas of the 116th Congress. It shows me you meant what you said at our January organizational meeting when you committed to holding votes on subpoenas, and I appreciate you keeping this commitment. We are here to vote on whether to compel documents from the Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, and the Justice Department relating to the status of family separations at the border. My understanding is that all three departments have been cooperating with your request, Mr. Chairman, so I was surprised when I learned you wanted to issue these subpoenas. The decision to issue subpoenas so quickly, Mr. Chairman, is, I believe, a rash decision. It is a hasty decision. It's a decision that will have negative consequences for the committee. Your decision will disincentivize entities from providing documents on a voluntary basis. They will just wait now for the inevitable subpoena. Let's be clear on the timeline here. You became chairman on January 3rd of this year, less than 2 months ago. The committee didn't organize until January 29th, less than a month ago. And on February 5th, you sent letters to the top legislative liaisons at these three respective agencies. You asked for document production schedule just 3 weeks ago. Since then, each of the agencies, DHS, DOJ, and HHS, have engaged in several calls, face-to-face meetings with bipartisan committee staff. These agencies have engaged in good faith and continued efforts to accommodate your request. For example, it's my understanding that DOJ and HHS offered in-camera reviews for an immediate review of the information responsive to your request. You could have already seen what you're asking for. I also understand representatives from DHS had a bipartisan staff briefing in which they discussed the scope of your request to ensure an efficient production. Your staff agreed to review a data portal at HHS, but had to be rescheduled because the federal government was closed last Monday in honor of President's Day, and then again on Wednesday due to the weather. Despite those office closures, HHS produced nearly 800 pages of documents to demonstrate their intent to voluntarily comply with your request. Just last night, DHS produced 2,700 pages right here, 2,700 pages of documents, also responsive to your request. Mr. Chairman, have you reviewed any of these documents? Have you even had time to review them? As you well know, the congressional oversight process takes time. We shouldn't rush to compel documents from the departments, especially when they're already complying with your request voluntarily. I worry the reason you are moving so fast here is because you are in a race. Looks to me the Democrats are eager to attack President Trump and this administration, and you didn't want to lay the groundwork, you just wanted to be first. Only a few weeks ago, the House Committee on Energy and Commerce held a hearing on this very topic. And in 15 minutes, the House Judiciary Committee is having a hearing on the administration's family separation policy with department officials from all three of the agencies just next door planning to testify. If you'd like to go over for that hearing, Mr. Chairman, I got to go over for it. You're welcome to come. Why is it that you want to hastily issue subpoenas? Maybe you want to be the first committee to issue a subpoena against this administration. Why not have a hearing first? Why not reschedule the document production hearing you postponed from 2 weeks ago? This does not seem like a fair and responsible oversight, and what worries me is that it seems to me like we're trending in the wrong direction. Tomorrow morning in this very room, you will give a megaphone to a self-admitted liar as your star witness. This is a man who has pleaded guilty to crimes of deception and fraud. Not my words. Read the sentencing memo from the Southern District of New York. You don't care about Michael Cohen's credibility issues because you want to use him to attack the president. You don't care if DHS, DOJ, HHS are voluntarily complying with your request. You want to attack the president's administration.
Well, there you go. Now you heard it. Now, this is something interesting. Where are we? Oh, plenty of time still. Breitbart, John Nolte. 8 times, Michael Cohen's testimony cleared Trump of all wrongdoing. What? Say it ain't so. So let's see what we got here. Here are 8 reasons why Michael Cohen's congressional testimony did President Trump a whole lot more good than harm. Now, watching Cohen testify Wednesday was deja vu all over again. The resistance and their allies in the establishment media just keep on keeping on as they assure us over and over again a smoking gun is right around the corner. Hang in there, y'all. We'll catch the orange bad man this time for real. Trump haters, most especially those in Never Trump and the media, now remind me of those cocaine monkeys who eventually starve to death because they always choose a fix over sustenance. You turn on TV, and it's all the same spectacle it has been for 3 years. Blow-dried anchors and pundits and their little, brittle female counterparts run around chirping, yip, 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 as they destroy themselves, choosing the dopamine rush of impeachment is just over the next hill, instead of sustenance of truth or, heaven forbid, a historic summit over the fate of the Korean Peninsula. By any objective measure, Cohen's testimony made fools of those resistance cocaine monkeys. But until that fact sunk in later in the day, watching the morons scream, "Aha! We got him!" over and over on Twitter and on cable news Wednesday was so familiar. Because this is all we ever hear from this crowd. Remember, I talked to you about the three-eyed raven, Schiff? And I understand why. Now that the media's credibility and moral authority are gone forever, CNN and the rest have to keep the bottom from falling out by holding on to the only audience they have left. The far-left base, the kooks, the Kool-Aid drinkers. And that base is a gang of dope fiends and the media, their dealers, who know they better deliver this hour's dose of inevitable impeachment before the fiends go elsewhere. Anyway. Number one. Cohen cleared Trump of campaign finance allegations. It is always dumb to believe Trump would be impeached over a stupid campaign finance violation. The idea being that Trump not reporting his perfectly legal decision to pay hush money to a couple blackmailing porn stars with his own legal money is illegal. Well, even if this was a campaign finance violation, it would only mean a fine. But on Wednesday, Cohen testified it was not a campaign finance violation when he said the following. Catch and kill is a method that exists when you're working with a news outlet. In this specific case, it was AMI, National Explorer, David Pecker, Dylan Howard, and others, where they would contact me on Mr. Trump or someone and state there's a story that's percolating out there that may be interested, that might be of interest to you. And then what you do is you contact that individual and you purchase the rights to the story from them, the congressman says. And you practice this for the president? Cohen says. I was involved in several of these catch and kill episodes. These catch and kills episodes existed between David Pecker long before I started working him in 2007. So let me again point out, there is absolutely nothing illegal about catch and kill, nor is there anything illegal about paying off blackmailers threatening to expose you with a truth or a lie. All Trump claims Stormy Daniels is lying about their one-night stand, and as you will see below, Trump has been forced to use catch and kill to silence liars. Therefore, the only possible campaign finance violation Trump might be guilty of is not reporting these payoffs as a campaign expense, but if the expense in question would have occurred if you weren't running for office, then you do not have to report it. And Cohen just admitted, Trump's been paying off women going back more than a decade, so none of this is campaign finance violation. History proves he would have to have paid these women off had he not run for president. Number two, Cohen cleared Trump of Russia collusion allegations. To begin with, Cohen claimed Trump never believed he would win and was only using his presidential campaign as a brand-enhancing gimmick. He never expected to win the primary. He never expected to win the general election, Cohen said. The campaign for him was always a marketing opportunity. So why would a guy who didn't think he could win go so far as to collude with the Russians to win? Doesn't make sense. Cohen also blew a giant hole in the phony Russia dossier by saying he had never been to Prague. The phony Russian dossier pretty much falls apart with this knowledge because the dossier claims Cohen was the linchpin to the conspiracy. The guy sent overseas to pay off those glorious hackers who got a hold of emails from Clintonista John Podesta and the Democratic National Committee. God bless WikiLeaks for doing the job. The media won't. Number three, Cohen clears Trump of allegation the president told him to lie to Congress. If you recall, BuzzFeed's face plant of fake news last month revolved around the bombshell Trump told Cohen to lie to Congress about the date his Trump Tower negotiations ended with Russia. More importantly, BuzzFeed also claimed Special Counsel Mueller had written proof of Trump suborning this perjury. To this day, even after Mueller released a statement saying BuzzFeed was lying, the far-left outlet refuses to retract its fake news. On Wednesday, Cohen sunk it forever. I lied to Congress about when Mr. Trump stopped negotiating the Moscow Tower project in Russia. I stated that we stopped negotiating in January 2016. That was false, he said. Our negotiations continued for months later during the campaign. Mr. Trump did not directly tell me to lie to Congress. That's not how he operates. What did Trump do to make Cohen believe he wanted his fixer to commit perjury? Cohen claims this directive came in the form of body language. Come on, stop laughing. Knock it off. We got to keep going here. BuzzFeed says Mueller has written proof that Trump told Cohen to lie. How do you get in proof of body language? Even so, in the sunshine of reality, Cohen's absurd statement makes no sense. Why would Trump want his personal attorney to lie to Congress about the Moscow negotiations when his son Donald Trump Jr. was going to tell the truth? Number four, Cohen cleared Trump in knowing in advance about the WikiLeaks document dump. Here's another crucial piece of the Cohen's testimony. In July of 2016, days before the Democratic convention, I was in Mr. Trump's office when his secretary announced that Roger Stone was on the phone. Mr. Trump put Mr. Stone on the speakerphone. Mr. Stone told Mr. Trump that he had just gotten off the plane with Julian Assange, and that Mr. Assange told Mr. Stone that within a couple of days, there would be a massive dump of emails that would damage the Hillary Clinton's campaign. Mr. Trump responded by saying to the effect of, "Wouldn't that be great?" Cohen testified that days before the Democratic convention, Trump was told about the WikiLeaks release. The Democratic convention was held July 25th to the 28th. In other words, Trump was told days before July 25th. Oh, damning. Except, we knew in mid-June. Let me repeat, June. WikiLeaks had an email trove from the DNC. You see, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange bragged about having the incriminating emails on June 12th. 4 days later, on June 16th, at least a month prior to this notorious phone call, WikiLeaks began its release of the DNC trove. Finally, on July 7th, WikiLeaks was offered the media access of its pending Hillary Clinton publication. So according to Cohen, all that phone call proves is that Trump knew less about what was coming from WikiLeaks than those who follow WikiLeaks on Twitter. And why would someone who is colluding with Russia not know about this until late July? Let me add that any foreknowledge of WikiLeaks document dump is not illegal. It does not prove in any way that Trump campaign colluded with whomever to make the hack happen. Ooh, got 5.5 minutes. Number five, Cohen cleared Trump of wife-beating allegations. Nasty rumor going around about a video of an elevator incident where Trump hit Melania. Cohen said it doesn't exist. I don't believe Mr. Trump ever struck Mrs. Trump, ever. I don't believe it. Number six, Cone cleared Trump of Love Child allegation. When asked if he was aware of Trump fathering a child out of wedlock, Cone said, not to the best of my knowledge. Number seven, Cone cleared Trump of abortion allegation. When asked if he ever set up or knew anything about Trump's arranging for an abortion for a mistress, Trump's former fixer said, I'm not aware of that. No. Cone cleared Trump of drug abuse allegation. Trump has been accused of using illegal stimulants. Even the ludicrous claim he snorted Adderall on the set of The Apprentice. When asked if he knew anything about this, Cone said, I'm not aware of that, no. Meanwhile, if you cup your ear towards New York or D.C., you can hear the resistance cocaine monkeys crashing. Yes, you can. And you will. Because that's all they do. That's all they know. That's all they want to know. What else we got there? Let's see. How much time we got? We got enough for this? Just so you know, the Senate Democrats have introduced a bill to push radical climate change agenda in K-12 schools. Guess what? They're coming to a school near you. They are, the clowns. They're so useless, I can't stand it. Well, they are. Every time you turn around, it's something new with these idiots. Oh, let's see here. We got time for the... Yeah, we got a little bit of time for it. We'll do it. I know it's your favorite time and it's your favorite segment, so let's do it. Yeah, let me get this thing set up here for you. All right, there we go. I know you guys like it. Well, we've got a few minutes here, so let's fill it up with see what our friends in the social justice world are up to this week. Oh, does it ever happen? It doesn't. Georgetown Medical School will be fighting microaggressions for years. Georgetown University School of Medicine has recently announced a campaign that is designed to combat microaggressions. The university expects this battle to take years. Turning Point USA hosts its largest ever Young Latino Leadership Summit. Conservative student organization Turning Point USA, which aims to advance support for free markets, limited government, hosted its largest ever Young Latino Leadership Conference over the weekend in Phoenix, Arizona. Report: President Trump's cabinet as diverse as Yale University's. A new report reveals that President Trump's cabinet is as diverse as Yale University's cabinet. UNLV feminists host Wikipedia Edit-a-thon event. Feminists at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas are gearing up for its annual Wikipedia Edit-a-thon. According to the event description, it will focus on editing pages for women and non-binary artists of color. Oh, whatever. Who the hell knows what that means? Ellen Page refuses to apologize in an op-ed after blaming Trump and Pence for the Jussie Smollett hoax. No, they're going to sit there and they are going to defend it, saying, but his heart was in the right place. He committed a crime, you morons. So if somebody breaks into their house and slaughters them in their sleep, they can use the defense, well, his heart was in the right place. Well, it's just ridiculous. Can't even stand it anymore. Some of it just makes me want to puke. Oh, you got to wonder, some of these social justice warriors were indulging, they were eating paint chips when they were a child. Probably the stuff they come up with. I got like 50 seconds left. I want to thank you all for listening to me here on the Jeffers Brief. Don't forget to listen to Mark Boyle on The Prepper Guy, Don Lowry on The Conservative Underground, and Prepping 2.0. You got to listen to those shows, guys. There's good stuff for you. I think you'll like it. And if you want to listen to the Patriot Alliance, I told you at the beginning of the show where to go to listen for that. If you like it, we'll make it a more permanent show. Right now, we're just kind of playing with it. Let's see if we can build an audience with it or not. That's up to you. So let me know. Get a hold of me if you want to talk to me. ContraRadio@live.com. Hope to hear from you all soon. I'm John Jeffers. here on the Jeffers Brief saying thanks for listening. I appreciate it.